That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Arthur Snell. The climate crisis in North America is acute. Around 53 million people are living in drought conditions. Hurricane events have become more severe and more frequent, causing billions of dollars of damage every year. And of course, glaciers are melting at an accelerated rate. In spite of all this, the Biden administration recently greenlighted a massive drilling operation in Alaska called Project Willow, which has been described as a carbon bomb due to the incredible amounts of CO2 set to be released by it. To discuss this and the wider context, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Michael Gerard, who's the Andrew Sabin Professor of Professional Practice at Columbia Law School and founder and director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law. Michael, welcome.
Good to be with you.
As I mentioned in the introduction there, these are troubling times for anyone who cares about the climate change question. Of course, we've just had the most recent report from the UNFCCC about the degree to which climate change may even be irreversible at 1.5 degrees. And in the face of what appears to be governments failing to take the appropriate action, you and other lawyers around the world are seeing if this can be confronted in a litigation context. So could you perhaps say a little bit for the unfamiliar listener about the idea of climate change law and the role of litigation?
So we maintain a database of all the climate litigation around the world. We've counted about 2,100 lawsuits that have been brought around the world on climate change. Now, not all of them are seeking to hasten the fight against climate change. Some of them are going in the other direction. But what we've seen, especially in the last 5 years or so, especially outside the United States, is lawsuits that are successfully persuading courts to require national governments to take stronger action on climate change. We've seen that in the Netherlands, in Germany, France, Brazil, Nepal, quite a number of countries around the world where the courts are really requiring governments to act more aggressively on climate change.
This is obviously a pioneering element of sort of modern law practice. Are there any cases yet demonstrated where a case has been brought against a government has lost that case, and then a major sort of policy change has had to be implemented as a result?
Yes, the most famous of these cases was called Urgenda Foundation against Kingdom of the Netherlands, where the Supreme Court of the Netherlands ruled that the pledge that the country had made as part of the Paris Climate Agreement was too weak, that it needed to step up and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to a greater extent, and the government has been acting on that. Likewise, in Germany, the federal courts in Germany found that the government was not doing enough, and a similar rulings from in a number of cases in France. So that has actually happened.
I want to talk a bit about the situation in your own country. Many people will recall that one of the election pledges made by President Biden was that there would be no drilling on federal land. And I think there's a recording of him saying, period, 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 just in case you weren't quite sure what he meant. And yet this famous, maybe I could say notorious, Project Willow, which will be in Alaska, was recently green-lighted. Is that then an opening for litigation in the U.S. context?
The litigation is already open. There's been litigation about that particular project for years. And when President Biden made the disappointing announcement that he was going to allow the Willow Project, there was new litigation started. Now, it's a complicated legal situation because the company involved, Chevron, has a lease from the Bureau of Land Management to do oil drilling there. They've had that lease for years, and that gives them certain rights. So any denial would also end up in court brought by the oil company. President Biden is also in a tough situation because he has a very narrow majority in the Senate, 51 Democrats, and one or two of the senators, especially Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is shaky on this. And so Biden has to do a lot to try to mollify Manchin, which I think is also an element here. But anything that administrations in the U.S. do on climate change in one direction or the other will end up in court.
Yeah. And you mentioned Joe Manchin there. And of course, for listeners who aren't familiar, you know, he represents West Virginia, which has a history of coal mining. And some people have also pointed to his own sort of personal involvement in that industry. Do you think that Biden's change of heart is in any way affected by the global situation? And I'm thinking particularly events in Europe, the war in Ukraine, which has perhaps emphasized the need for countries to have a measure of energy independence.
There's no question that the Ukraine war has changed the global energy situation. It has meant that the U.S. Is especially eager to export liquefied natural gas to Europe. There are several new LNG export terminals that have either just opened or are under construction. It's made it more difficult to address the climate situation as aggressively as we had hoped. The G7 meeting that just concluded led to a communique in which energy security seems to be taking first place in front of climate change.
And yet one could argue that, of course, the ultimate energy security would be to invest in renewable energies and not be reliant on global hydrocarbon exports and imports.
Of course, both renewables and energy efficiency. What we have seen coming out of the war is a tremendous upsurge in heat pumps, which are an excellent way to use less energy and still provide the same heating. It's largely a matter of pace and scale. How quickly can we scale up energy efficiency and renewables? And that may happen at a somewhat slower pace than exporting LNG. However, each of these LNG terminals costs many billions of dollars, and its owners want it to keep on operating for a long time.
Sure. With this Project Willow, I mentioned in the introduction, there's this idea of it being a carbon bomb, and this sort of the long-term implications of it possibly making it almost impossible for the U.S. to meet certain commitments it has made on climate targets. Is that the, in simplest terms, the basis for a legal claim that it is impossible for the government to maintain its own commitments, or are there more complexities? I'm sure there are more, but is there a different fundamental argument?
The U.S. climate commitments are not really legally binding. The U.S. has not passed a congressional statute that sets those commitments in stone. There are things that were set forth by President Biden, but we know that when Donald Trump was in office, he revoked the U.S. commitment. So the legal issues around the Willow Project are more on the details of environmental review and leasing and so forth. But let me just say that, yeah, it's called a climate bomb. There are lots of climate bombs that are out there. This is not one project that's going to tip us over the edge. Now, maybe we've already tipped over the edge, but the project is important, but in it in itself, it does not make it a game changer. And of course, equally important to restricting the supply of fossil fuels is to restrict the demand for fossil fuels. The great bulk of all petroleum goes to motor vehicles, and a central part of the effort has to be the switching over to electric vehicles as quickly as we can, as well as improving mass transit and other ways to reduce the amount of vehicle miles traveled.
Is there a role for legal action in that context, in terms of as you say, changing demand as well as changing the supply?
So the principal jobs are with the regulators. So in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration set the fuel economy and vehicle emission standards. The Department of Energy sets energy efficiency standards for appliances and so forth. Where the courts come in is challenges to those rules and trying to defend them. But it's difficult for, without a basis in statute or regulation, to have the courts try to require a reduction in demand.
So you still need a government to take the initial step to say that there's a minimum standard here, there's a minimum expectation, effectively.
That's right. Yeah, we also have action in the private sector, of course. There are various private efforts at encouraging energy efficiency in buildings. But the most important factors here are having government regulations that require greater efficiency.
People will be well aware, of course, of the U.S. legal structure and the existence of a Supreme Court in which the justices are appointed on a political basis, and the fact that at the moment the Supreme Court is heavily dominated by Republican appointees. Do you think that has any impact on the possibilities for success? Is the partisanship that's seen on some other legal questions present in this debate?
Unfortunately, yes. Last summer, the Supreme Court issued a decision in a case called West Virginia versus EPA, which constrained to a certain extent EPA's ability to regulate emissions from coal-fired power plants. And we're not sure beyond that, but the U.S. Supreme Court has become something of an impediment to the strongest possible action in the U.S.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
We've talked a lot about this context of focusing on governmental and sort of state or federal agencies. What is the potential role and benefit that could be drawn from legal action against private businesses, and particularly if we're talking about the sort of the huge global oil and gas firms?
So there are quite a few lawsuits that are brought against against companies in the fossil fuel industry. One very prominent case is called Milieu Defense versus Royal Dutch Shell, in which a trial-level court of the Netherlands ordered Royal Dutch Shell to reduce its emissions, not just those of the corporation, but also of its subsidiaries, not only those in the Netherlands, but globally. And very importantly, not only those from its direct emissions, like leakage from its oil wells, but also of its customers. This decision is now under appeal in the Dutch courts, but if it holds up, it's going to be extremely important, and we may see similar lawsuits in other countries. In the United States, there have been efforts going back to 2004 to hold oil and gas companies responsible for climate change. The most recent wave of these, which has been going on for the last 6 years, has all been held up in the courts on the question of whether they belong in federal court or state court. The plaintiffs, for various reasons, all want to be in state court. The oil companies all want to be in federal court. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court let stand several decisions to say they belong in state court. So I think we'll see a lot more activity in those cases in the United States in the couple of years to come.
And for those who are less familiar with the structure of the U.S. legal system, what's the significance of that state court versus federal court argument? Does that it makes litigation easier in some way?
Well, there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2011, which made it tougher for the federal court to take this kind of case. The state courts may not have the same constraint. In some of the states, that may be a more sympathetic venue. And so there are a number of these legal reasons why the plaintiffs, who in these cases are mostly states and cities, all want to be in state court.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the wider sort of international and global picture. And you've mentioned, of course, some case studies from the Netherlands and one or two other countries. There are some countries, notably Pacific Island states, and I'm aware, I think, that you've worked in some cases for the Marshall Islands. There are some countries whose entire existence is at risk from rising sea levels. Is there anything that those countries can do on an international legal basis, either to somehow to seek to reverse this tendency or to find some kind of compensation for their entire populations?
So one of the endangered Pacific Island nations, Vanuatu, pressed the effort to get in front of the International Court of Justice with a question of the obligation of the major developed countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and possibly take other actions. In order to get before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, it was necessary to obtain a majority vote of the members of the United Nations General Assembly. About a month ago, they succeeded. Quite remarkably, there was a consensus vote with no dissent to send this case to the International Court of Justice. So that court, which will be hearing this case probably next year, doesn't have the ability to issue a binding decision in a case like this, but it could declare legal obligations that the domestic courts in several countries will pick up on and use to press their own governments. This is mostly about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It's tougher to obtain compensation. There really isn't a clear legal pathway for the small island states to obtain financial compensation for the grievous injury that climate change is causing them. That's more a matter of international politics and diplomacy.
This case that you mentioned with Vanuatu, obviously, the International Court of Justice, as you say, can't issue a binding judgment on another state, but presumably it would have a lot of influence. But at the same time, as we've seen in the case of the Biden administration, but perhaps much more severely so in the case of the Trump administration, you need buy-in at that political level. And it feels that among Western countries, this politicization of the climate change question is particularly acute in the US context. It certainly exists in Australia, but you don't see it so much in Europe. What do you think explains this kind of left-right politicization of the climate change question in your country?
So, of course, climate change is far from being the only issue where there is a stark left-right division. And there are many, many theories about it. Part of it traditionally is distaste of big government, that if you're going to take climate change seriously, there's a major role for government. If you don't believe much in government regulation, you don't want to be regulating climate change as well as a lot of other things. There's also the politics with the fossil fuel industry contributes a lot of money to campaigns. It's very politically influential. The way the Constitution was written in 1789 gives a disproportionate power to rural states with relatively low population, many of which produce a lot of oil and gas and coal. And so there are many aspects to the U.S. Political system that combine to make climate change a partisan issue today. Let me just say, it wasn't always that way. The major environmental laws of the United States were just about all enacted during a 20-year period between 1970 and 1990. And they were all enacted with very strong support from Republicans as well as Democrats. In 2008, the major presidential candidates, John McCain for the Republicans and Barack Obama for the Democrats, both supported climate legislation. They both supported cap and trade. It's more recently than that that we've had this partisan division on climate change, but that partisan division has grown wider and wider with each passing federal election.
And the interesting thing, coming at it from a UK perspective, where we certainly have very partisan politics, but on climate change, there tends not to be so much of a division. But the other thing that strikes me, and I wonder whether there's anything in your own sort of life history, because I've read a bit about your background, is that it seems to me that some of the parts of the US that are most heavily affected by climate change are also the parts of the US where politicians seem to be rejecting its existence. And that just, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance there. It's quite hard to get one's head around.
Well, you're certainly right about that. Florida, for instance, is a state that is very vulnerable to climate change with flooding and so forth. And yet the current government doesn't want to deal with that at all. The southern states in general tend to be more conservative, but those are the states that are going to be most heavily affected by extreme heat. But there are just so many other aspects of politics going on that that overwhelm the merits here, that people are really acting against their interests with respect to climate change when they oppose action on climate change.
Finally, in the last few minutes that we've got, I wanted to try to look forward a little because people who take an interest in this subject want there to be this sense of global urgency, that time is running out, that governments need to take action. And yet, at the same time, a lot of these sorts of processes, including the legal system, moves at a fairly sluggish pace, often for reasons that are very valid. But what is your sense of the speed at which people such as yourself can take these kinds of actions versus the rate of change in the climate crisis, and whether or not we're on a trajectory that takes us where we want to be?
We are not on the trajectory that is taking us where we want to be. There are some encouraging signs, more on the technological front. There are very rapid developments in improving the efficiency and reducing the costs of wind and solar and storage and so forth, electric vehicles, batteries, all the technologies that we need in order to address the problem are really developing very quickly. And the U.S. did last year pass an important law called the Inflation Reduction Act, which makes at least hundreds of billions of dollars available for that. I think we're having the greatest success there on the technology more than on the politics, but the curves of emissions and so forth are not heading in the directions that they need to.
And if you had to sort of name one legal case, one litigation or other action which you feel could have the greatest impact, which would that be? What should people be watching out for?
I think this Dutch case against Royal Dutch Shell is very important, and the world is really going to be watching what happens there.
Great. Well, we'll be watching that case. And Michael Gerard, thank you so much for joining us today in The Bunker.
Thank you.
The Bunker is free to download, but if you like what you're hearing and want to make sure there's more where this came from, then you can back us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us to keep bringing new podcasts. I'm Arthur Snell, and thanks for listening.
The Bunker USA was written and presented by Arthur Snell. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Jade Bailey and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker USA is a Podmasters production.